This podcast is entitled Malcolm, X equals MC squared, recalibrating a strategy for success, and is based on an article that I first wrote on the 27th of February this year. I've considered it necessary to produce it as a podcast following the events of George Floyd's death and the ensuing protests, marches, discussions, and seismic changes globally, particularly in the Western context. The 55th anniversary of Malcolm X's death witnessed a plethora of articles, discussions, and interviews regarding his legacy. The most revealing to date was the six-part Netflix docuseries Who Killed Malcolm X, due to it unearthing new information considered significant enough for the Manhattan District Attorney's Office to review the case. Malcolm's life continues to inspire countless people from a variety of cultures and faiths around the world. The emphasis of this podcast is on particular stages of Malcolm X's life and whether they resonate within a 21st century British context. This is necessary due to an absence of similar examples available to young people, particularly disenfranchised urban youth, facing myriad challenges among a toxic, unrelenting environment in which criminality and violence have become almost everyday features. In an article on the 19th of September from the Financial Times, we see the following, quote, "In Britain today, serious youth violence is a hydra. When the state attempts to kill it using brute force, two heads grow where one is cut off. This cannot be allowed to become the new normal. Almost one third of UK children live in poverty," end quote. Until relatively recently, Malcolm's life has been examined and critiqued through prisms of racial discrimination and social injustice. However, discourse regarding what would be his final socio-religious transformation to Sunni Islam and the implications of this has seldom been discussed on a transnational level insofar as it affects Black British youth. Some consider this a deliberate oversight, an obfuscation of Malcolm's gravitation towards a more universally encompassing strategy in an attempt to dilute the impact of Sunni religious orthodoxy on his ultimate psyche. Even less has been explored regarding the relevance of his experiences within a UK context. It is therefore necessary to examine particular instances of his life to determine whether they are transferable and can be recalibrated as a template for the socio-political empowerment of today's youth. In an effort to facilitate this process, I will utilise the four-phase cognitive development framework developed during my PhD study. This theoretical perspective examines developmental stages of British Muslim converts and is consistent with the aspects of conversion theory. By referencing the framework, aspects of Malcolm's life can be juxtaposed with similar experiences of Black British youth. This will enable a unique overview of the type of trajectories available to such youth, identify particular milestones and provide, if necessary, specific interventions in order to facilitate their empowerment. In the event, lessons can be derived from the above-mentioned approach with a view to providing further discourse regarding the practical implementation or adaptation of existing youth development models. The end of the beginning. Malcolm's spiral into criminality occurred during early adulthood and is vividly described in his autobiography. It should suffice to recount specific incidents that could be considered synonymous with youth delinquency today. Drug dealing was the principal predilection for Malcolm, to the extent he became involved in smuggling them across particular states. The premise upon which County Lines flourishes across parts of 21st century Britain is not by any means a new phenomenon. Quoting from his autobiography, "Then Sammy gave me an idea. Red, you still got your old railroad identification?" They hadn't taken it back. "Well, why don't you use it to make a few runs?" The idea came to me that this way I could travel all over the East Coast selling reefers, drugs, among my friends who were on tour with their bands. When I ran out of supplies, I'd return to New York and load up, then hit the road again." End quote. While County Lines is arguably more sophisticated and on a larger scale compared to Malcolm's experience, Similarities remain evident when considering factors like the transportation of drugs for specific clientele across regional borders. Some may assert no other similarities exist beyond this, and that the absence of any exploited or vulnerable party separates the two examples proffered in this instance. However, the counter-argument would be to highlight Malcolm's fate since early childhood, the disintegration of his family and subsequent disenfranchisement from mainstream society. The ensuing trauma caused by both undoubtedly influenced his outlook and perceptions. In fact, the socio-economic and racial climate during his era was inarguably a contributory factor behind his sense of victimhood. Indeed, more than 50 years on, this sagacity continues to be prevalent among many facing similar circumstances. Quoting from the National Crime Agency report on the 25th of February, when I accessed it, county lines is a term used when drug gangs from big cities expand their operations to smaller towns, often using violence to drive out local dealers and exploiting children and vulnerable people to sell drugs. End quote. Another area of criminality, also luridly detailed in the autobiography, was prostitution. Malcolm's residence, familiarity, and subsequent involvement with prostitution was a source of supplementary revenue alongside various minor hustles he was involved in. Quoting again from his autobiography, "It was in this house that I learned more about women than I did in any other single place. It was these prostitutes who schooled me to things that every wife and every husband should know." End quote. Prostitution within the UK today is seldom equated to black youth. However, instead, there is disproportionate representation of another minority as it relates to sexual grooming gangs and the abuse of minors, predominantly young white females. That said, the number of South Asians arrested and imprisoned for these types of offences remain a cause for serious concern, particularly considering the traditional and occasionally religious upbringing and backgrounds of these convicted parties. In any event, a minority of young people from African Caribbean backgrounds may have been either marginally involved or witnessed elements of prostitution in and around a few environments. This was certainly the case during part of my childhood, between the ages of 9 and 11 years old to be specific. Some friends and I became acquainted with a few prostitutes who frequented and touted business on Bedford Hill, once part of a notorious red light district in South London. Our estate was situated at the bottom of the hill, and we would occasionally accompany particular workers, acting as lookouts or pretending to be younger siblings in order to remove suspicion surrounding their presence in that locality. No remuneration was ever exchanged due to a tacit code of conduct, acknowledging the existence of a type of solidarity between members coming from similar strata of society. Malcolm and his associates would have also recognised this unspoken code during that era. It is important to recall Malcolm's age during this level of delinquency and compare it to those in similar circumstances within a UK context today, because very little has changed. In the absence of suitable intervention strategies or support networks to tackle those self-destructive pathways, many young people will have few options except to continue along trajectories and invariably result in criminality, imprisonment, and even death. The drastic effects of austerity upon youth provision have contributed towards the current knife crime pandemic witnessed among young people. Quoting from an article in The Independent on the 7th of May 2019, "Rising knife crime could be linked to budget cuts that have decimated youth services in parts of England, according to a parliamentary report. The average council has reduced spending on services such as social clubs and youth workers by 40%, and some places have seen funding plummet by 91% in 3 years." End quote. I will refer to the first of the cognitive openings now, that being the founding phase. This phase of conversion addresses the formative stages and the influences or drivers that caused individuals to convert to Islam. This stage also relates to individuals who are becoming more aware and familiarised with their religion. Malcolm was 21 years old when he entered prison. When comparing his relatively young age of imprisonment, more than 50 years ago, with black youth incarcerated in UK prisons today, we witness some startling facts. Quoting from the Guardian report on the 29th of January 2019, more than half of the inmates held in prisons for young people in England and Wales are from a black and minority ethnic BME background, the highest proportion on record. About 51% of boys in young offender institutions, YOIs, prisons for boys aged 15 to 17, and young adult men aged 18 to 21, identified as being from BME backgrounds, Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Prisons found. End quote. 10 years ago, the situation was also dismal. Quoting from another Guardian article on the 11th of October 2010 this time, the proportion of black people in jail in the UK was almost seven times their share of the population, end quote. Labour MP Diane Abbott observed during this particular period, there was never a serious examination of the consequences of locking up a generation of young black men. The result is there are some prisons in the southeast that are now virtually all black. Many are converting to Islam. That was from the same article source. Compare this to Malcolm's observations regarding US prisons over half a century earlier, quoting from his autobiography. This is probably as big a single worry as the American prison system has today. The way the Muslim teachings circulated among all Negroes in the country are converting new Muslims among black men in prison, and black men in prison in far greater numbers than their proportion in the population, end quote. Diane Abbott's Labour colleague David Lammy published a more recent review examining the treatment and outcomes for BME individuals in the criminal justice system, warning that youth jails had reached US levels of disproportionality. Abbott referred to the increase in conversions among black inmates. However, this is nothing new. As far back as 1999, 37% of black inmates were converts, disproportionately so when considering they constituted a mere 7% of the wider populace. In fact, later research highlighted that overall 30% of all Muslim inmates comprised largely of black rather than Asian ethnic groups. Malcolm's reflections on the cause and effects of his imprisonment are likely to resonate with converts who have encountered similar experiences, quoting from his autobiography again. I had sunk to the very bottom of the American white man's society. In prison, I found Allah and the religion of Islam, and it completely transformed my life, end quote. He was later to acknowledge that what he understood to be Islam as being antithetical to the monotheistic and religious orthodoxy of mainstream Sunni practices. Nevertheless, the discipline, ethical code and structure of the Nation of Islam provided him with the required impetus for spiritual and educational self-development at that crucial time. Upon his release from prison, this black nationalist movement afforded him a comprehensive socio-religious, economic and familial infrastructure that offered the essential rehabilitative network. Unfortunately, and to reiterate a previous point, there is a dearth of similar initiatives to address the needs of former inmates, especially converts in Britain today. Indeed, one only has to look at the perpetrators behind the recent London Bridge and Streatham High Road terrorist attacks to acknowledge the woefully inadequate government programmes presently in place. Referring again to Malcolm's cognitive opening, we witness his continuing emphasis around introspection, realisation and a firm resolve for self-improvement. These traits continue to be distinctive features that accentuate many imprisoned converts' stimulus for change. Rambo's theoretical model succinctly encapsulates most, if not all, of the stages Malcolm underwent during imprisonment. The sequential stage model for pre-conversion comprises seven stages. 1. Context. 2. Crisis. 3. Quest. 4. Encounter. 5. Interaction. 6. Commitment. And 7. Consequence. The overarching founding phase of my theoretical framework is underscored by an idealism and vulnerability that can result in overdependence on charismatic personalities and abstract understandings, or both. Malcolm confirms being influenced by the former in relation to his mentor, NOI leader Elijah Muhammad, quoting from the autobiography again. My adoration of Mr. Muhammad grew in the sense of the Latin word adorare. It means much more than our adoration or adore. It means that my worship of him was so awesome that he was the first man whom I had ever feared. Not the fear such as a man with a gun, but the fear such as the one of the power of the sun, end quote. The importance of effective and holistic engagement with new converts during this critical phase of development cannot be understated, as sufficient evidence exists to highlight the disastrous consequences behind failures to address this substantial assertion. The next stage of development is also one underscored by elements of susceptibility, and it is where examples of Malcolm's increased activism will be examined. Cognitive opening 2. Overzealous ambitions and idealism, the youthful phase. The youthful phase is more idealistic and formative for individuals who have embraced Islam. This is another phase where converts are considered susceptible to extremist propaganda and teachings. Overzealousness is a common feature of many conversions, as in many instances, new converts possess heightened senses of self-righteousness with a desire to directly address and tackle the perceived ills of society. Malcolm was no different from many converts embracing a new faith, political ideology, or persuasion, and possessed an incessant desire to share his enlightenment with former colleagues. This period of exuberant proselytization is often an alienating experience for unsuspecting recipients and is frequently misinterpreted by them, causing offence in the process. A minority of converts rarely reflect on or indeed discern the somewhat overbearing nature of their approach during this phase, preferring instead to concentrate on the unyielding remit of their message, namely to convert others. Quoting from Malcolm's autobiography again, I've never been one for inaction. Everything I've ever felt strongly about, I've done something about. I soon began writing to people I had known in the hustling world, such as Sammy the Pimp, John Hughes, the gambling house owner, the thief Jumpsteady, and several doped peddlers. I wrote them all about Allah and Islam and Mr. Elijah Muhammad. And also, he stated, every day after work, I walked fishing for potential converts in the Detroit black ghetto, end quote. Malcolm's oratory skills and activism at this stage of his cognitive development largely contributed towards the NOI's rapid rise of new members. Mainstream media recognition also followed, as well as the attention of intelligence services like the FBI. As with most converts during this formative stage, perceptions of the wider society and relationships therein are redefined. It is not therefore uncommon for converts to withdraw from everyday society seeking insularity among like-minded co-religionists. A resistance identity often forms the basis of the convert's perceptions and his/her interaction with society, or conversely, withdrawal from it, and is determined by this new construct. S. Renani suggests resistant identity arises from a type of insecurity experienced by Muslims when facing an alien culture, Western culture in this instance. He cites the Black Muslim uprising under the banner of the Nation of Islam in the mid-1960s as an example of resistance identity that emerged in response to the discrimination and oppression of Black communities across the US. The paradigmatic shift towards a new identity provided Malcolm with a type of camaraderie he had never experienced earlier in life, especially among Black people. Quoting from his autobiography now, I had never dreamed of anything like that atmosphere among Black people, who had learned to be proud they were Black, who had learned to love other Black people, instead of being jealous and suspicious. I was thrilled to how we Muslim men used both hands to grasp a Black brother's both hands, voicing and smiling our happiness to meet him again. End quote. This stage of transformation was cemented with the appellation X to his name that, quote, replaced the white slave master name of Little imposed upon my paternal forebears. The receipt of my X meant that forever after I would be known as Malcolm X. End quote. Converts to mainstream Sunni Islam frequently adopt new, often Arabic, and relatively recently African names, as demarcation of their new faith. However, such changes are not contingent upon abandonment of pre-conversion anglicized names. Referring again to Malcolm's first real experience of black solidarity and extending this within a British context, the absence of any similar sentiment among sections of black communities, particularly converts, is palpable. Few institutions or entities that boast black ownership or indeed leadership exist, resulting in the dispersion of converts among wider, traditionally led and culturally based non-black communities, i.e. South Asian and Arab. Unfortunately, black converts' presence among such communities often results in subtle discrimination towards them and marginalization. This is despite an established fact that black Muslims existed in the UK well before the arrival of now predominantly South Asian diaspora. And citing a particular article from Al Jazeera on the 22nd of June 2018, we see black Muslims were part of the British landscape long before South Asian migrants arrived in the 1960s. From the Moors of North Africa, who came to Elizabethan England, to even Shakespeare's Othello, end quote. These challenges will be revisited when focusing on possible remedies for socio-religious advancement. Continuing with Malcolm's youthful stage of cognitive progress, it is immediately evident that although many aspects of his activism were underscored by an idealism based on his devotion to the NOI message, an actualization of the causes of anti-black racism remained. In other words, Malcolm's lived experience of white America and the latter's stifling pervasiveness over black communities informed the degree and intensity of his activism, quoting from his autobiography. So, as a black man, and especially as a black American, any stand that I formally took, I don't think I would have to defend it, because it is still a reaction to the society, and it is a reaction that was produced by society. And I think it is the society that produced this and that should be attacked, not the reaction that develops among the people who are victims of that negative society, end quote. By contrast, the UK is yet to witness the emergence of consolidated leadership among black Muslim converts that address matters of identity and other socio-political issues affecting this small but growing segment of society. Other religious communities have established caucuses that actively represent their constituencies across the political spectrum. Converts either end up aligning themselves with these entities or completely abstain, resulting in the stagnation of social, educational, and political advancement among their own fledgling communities. Malcolm's initial involvement with the NOI provided a strong platform upon which he could articulate not only the challenges facing black Americans, but their requirements also. Throughout his activism, Malcolm's development continued, as did his awareness of disturbing contradictions within the NOI that would eventually result in his exile. Amidst the ensuing turmoil experienced towards the latter stages of his relationship with the organisation, he would undergo a further cognitive transformation. Cognitive Opening 3, Realisation, Review and Adjustment, the Adult Phase. This phase looks at more established Muslim converts who have practiced the religion long enough to have perhaps progressed from earlier understandings and practices of the first two stages. Their respective actualization of the religion, as opposed to practicing it in abstract, means that individuals at this stage have better understood and experienced the religion as a way of life, i.e. lived or travelled abroad to Muslim countries and engaged or participated in those societies, thereby enhancing his or her understanding and practice of Islam. Malcolm's separation from the NOI precipitated among the most transformative stages of his development. His newfound autonomy enabled opportunities for wider participation and engagement with other civil rights movements. His once scathing disregard for their leaders, like Martin Luther King, was transposed to a more inclusive, collaborative approach as he acknowledged the confluence of their respective messages. As different as Martin's and Malcolm's religious communities were, Martin's faith nonetheless was much closer to Malcolm's than it was to that of white Christians, and Malcolm's faith was much closer to Martin's than it was to Muslims in the Middle East or Asia. This was true because both of their faith commitments were derived from the same black experience of suffering and struggle in the United States. Their theologies, therefore, should be interpreted as different religious and intellectual responses of African Americans to their environment as they searched for meaning in a nation that they did not make. While each appealed to the practical side of their perspectives, the bottom line for both was faith and not pragmatism. Malcolm's faith was defined by the particularity of his blackness, and Martin's by the universality of his humanity. And that was a quote from J. Cohn's Martin and Malcolm and America, A Dream or a Nightmare. In a relatively short period, Malcolm proceeded to establish two entities that would reflect his respective socio-religious and socio-political focuses: Muslim Mosque Incorporated, MMI, and Organization of Afro-American Unity, OAAU. He described the first initiative's primary objective as, quote, a religious base and the spiritual force necessary to rid our people of the vices that destroy the moral fibre of our community, close quote. He elaborated further, declaring to reporters that it would be, quote, the working base for an action program designed to eliminate the political oppression, the economic exploitation and social degradation suffered daily by 22 million Afro-Americans, end quote. The parameters for his second entity, the OAAU, would be more expansive, engaging on both national and international scales. Quoting, so the purpose of the Organization of Afro-American Unity is to unite everyone in the Western Hemisphere of African descent into one united force. And then, once we are united among ourselves in the Western Hemisphere, we will unite with our brothers on the motherland, on the continent of Africa, end quote. In addition to establishing these organizations, he had also embarked on arguably the most decisive of spiritual journeys, the pilgrimage to Mecca. It was this experience that forever altered his previously ingrained perception regarding race in America. Quoting from him again, the color blindness of the Muslim world's religious society and the color blindness of the Muslim world's human society, these two influences had each day been making a greater impact and an increasing persuasion against my previous way of thinking. America needs to understand Islam because this is the one religion that erases from its society the race problem, end quote. His letters during sojourn in Mecca, together with interviews conducted following his return to the US, provide illustrative insights of his conversion to Sunni Islam and acknowledgement regarding the universality of mankind. Pilgrimage, Hajj, continues to impact Muslims of all persuasions in a similar manner to those described by Malcolm. As shall be discussed shortly, the euphoric levels achieved during the participation of this annual spectacle are, unfortunately, largely restricted to that particular occasion, due to xenophobic tendencies plaguing sections of some Muslim societies and their respective communities. The Hajj, while an integral part of the influence on Malcolm, was not the only catalyst for his seismic transformation at this stage. His travels throughout Africa contributed to the profound effect and impact on his social, cultural, and political consciousness. His dissociation from the NOI immediately saw him catapulted into the position as a global ambassador for Black America. African, not to mention Arab leaders, were therefore quick to endorse him. Conclusion. Cognitive opening 4. Reflection and wisdom, the mature phase. In the mature phase, the individual's perception may further develop or indeed change if they have not at earlier stages of post-conversion, due to a multiplicity of socio-economic, socio-cultural, and or religious factors. Malcolm's self-reflection attests his final transformation. Quote, my whole life has been a chronology of changes, end quote. His autobiography has undoubtedly inspired countless others to embark on similar journeys in order to induce individual as well as collective progress. His continuing legacy is a prototype for change, but it is essential that before completely yielding its benefits, attitudinal changes are necessary. Non-white communities readily embrace Malcolm's pursuit of justice against Western imperialism and systemic racism designed to discriminate against ethnic minorities, particularly the black populace. However, and it is within this context, decisive action is required when a similar, occasionally worse bigotry is witnessed against this same ethnic group by other, more predominant minorities like South Asians, Arabs, and or Somalis. The significance of Malcolm's legacy is overshadowed. It should be inconceivable for these communities to exhibit a type of bigotry synonymous to what black Americans and indeed they have experienced at the hands of wider society, especially if, as they claim, Malcolm represents their ideals. It should also be inconceivable as part of the Muslim diaspora to acclaim his declarations regarding the unity of mankind under a monotheistic deity while ignoring religious doctrines prohibiting xenophobia. Malcolm's observations regarding whiteness in this regard should be a clarion call for Muslim communities to commence realization of the religious ideals he embraced as a Sunni convert. Quoting from his autobiography once again, "We were truly the same, because their belief in one God had removed the white from their minds, the white from their behaviour, and the white from their attitudes." End quote. Replacing the adjective white with South Asian, Arab, or any other ethnic descriptor for predominant groups that exhibit anti-black racism is evidence of the profundity of Malcolm's statement. It is necessary to redefine our focus and redirect efforts to combat racism within these communities. Ongoing wider societal issues, such as structural and institutional racism, will continue to be challenged, but should no longer be a distraction from the suffocating effect of xenophobia among co-religionists. Black Muslim communities, converts in particular, need to reacquaint themselves with Malcolm's message, observing his metamorphosis into the role model he is today and using his timeless example as an incentive to accomplish whatever they set out to achieve. By any means necessary.